All rise. The Chief Judge and the judges of the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals, draw near, for the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. The court is called to order. The court calls the case of United States versus Staff Sergeant Joseph A. Turner, docket number 24067. In today's oral argument, we consider the following issue: whether appellant's plea was knowing and voluntary when the military judge did not ensure appellant was advised as to the adverse impact on his ability to own or possess a firearm as a result of a domestic violence conviction. Major Ward, are you prepared to proceed with oral argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
Major Beasold, are you prepared to proceed with oral argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. Major Ward, would you like to reserve time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Major Ward, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Chief Judge Morgan, members of the court, and may it please the court. I am Major Trevor Ward, and along with my co-counsel, Ms. Megan Marinos, I represent the appellant in this case, Staff Sergeant Joseph A. Turner. In this case, the military judge did not advise Sergeant Turner that by pleading guilty to a charge of domestic violence, he would be forever giving up his rights to own or possess firearms. Because this was a particularly severe penalty under the logic of United States versus Riley, the plea was not knowing or voluntary, and this court should set aside the conviction without prejudice. In United States versus Riley, the CAF held that a collateral consequence, when particularly severe, must be known to the accused before they can voluntarily and knowingly plead guilty.
I have a question for you.
Of course.
Just stop right there if you don't mind. Is it when the plea agreement encaptures the appellant or accused at the time's notification that he was fully advised by his counsel of any collateral consequences, does that shift a burden from determining that what you're asking is that we find that it's the military judge's error to the counsel for ineffective assistance of counsel, which is not a claim in this case?
That's correct. It's not a claim in this case, Your Honor, and the answer is no. In United States versus Riley, the CAF was clear that the responsibility is on the military judge to ensure the plea is knowing and voluntary. And a colloquy is required for particularly severe penalties, even if there's a blanket statement in the plea agreement indicating such. And that's true for at least sex offender registry, deportation, as well as the firearms prohibition. And the reason for that—
Counsel, in Miller, prior to Riley, the CAF had found that it was ineffective assistance of counsel. In that case, if the defense counsel didn't advise the accused of the sex offender registration consequences— If we were to find, agree with you in this case and find in favor of the appellant, wouldn't we also have to find that it was ineffective assistance of counsel?
Your Honor, that was not raised in this case, and so I think the answer is no. The military judge has an obligation on their own.
How would you square, though, that the military judge would have an obligation, but the trial defense counsel would not have to have an obligation, because appellant's own declaration states that he was not advised. And so we take it from that the trial defense counsel did not advise the appellant of the collateral consequence of a firearms ban.
Yes, Your Honor. I think the answer to your question is that it's still on the military judge. It still could be the case that, in this case, Major Grande committed ineffective assistance of counsel, at least erring and not advising Sergeant Turner of the firearms prohibition. But as Your Honor is aware, the Strickland analysis creates a really hard bar to meet. And one of the things that the government points out in their brief is that it creates a rational to plead not guilty standard, which Judge Stuckey talks about in his dissent in United States versus Riley. That's a really high bar to meet. But what the CAF majority recognized in United States versus Riley is that when we're talking about a knowing and voluntary plea, the question is, was the accused informed, whether that be by the defense counsel or the military judge? And if they weren't, then that's not a knowing and voluntary plea.
Counsel, if we were to accept your argument in this case, we would be creating a new rule. In other words, a new obligation that doesn't currently exist under our case law or precedent. What authority does this court have under Article 66 to create a new rule?
I don't think this court would be creating a new rule, Your Honor, and that's because the logic of United States versus Riley is directly on point to firearms prohibitions. So in that case, the CAF held that when a collateral consequence is a particularly severe penalty, it must be advised to the accused before the acceptance of the plea is knowing and voluntary. And they did so for three reasons: the intimate connection between the charge and the penalty, the lifetime nature of the penalty, and the implication of constitutional rights. All three of those apply with equal force to a firearms prohibition that they do with sex offender registry or deportation. And so for that reason, it wouldn't be a new rule. It would be following the CAF's guidance in United States versus Riley and holding that a particularly severe penalty, such as a firearms prohibition, must be advised to the accused before he can knowingly and voluntarily plead guilty.
So, counsel, if this is not a new rule, what is your position with respect to retroactive application?
Retroactive application as regards to the firearms prohibition colloquy?
Advisement, yes.
So in this case, and in cases like it, a military judge errs when they do not have the colloquy with the accused. I think that other cases may be different because there could be evidence in the record that the accused actually knew at the time that he pled guilty. That evidence simply doesn't exist in this case. The Air Force Form 177, which the government points to as some evidence, there are several problems with that. First, there was no colloquy between the military judge and the accused about that form, and so we don't know what Sergeant Turner's understanding of it was. But second, and perhaps worse, is that the form is wrong about the law. It says that a one-time conviction does not result in a lifetime ban. That's not true. Under Section 922 G9, there is a lifetime ban if you strike an intimate partner with and are charged with domestic violence for that offense. And so the form, even if Sergeant Turner knew about it, articulates the wrong law, and he was misinformed by that form.
Well, I guess I'm just looking for clarity on the retroactivity. If it's not a new rule, then under our case law, it applies retroactively. So if I understand your argument, every case currently pending or decided, it would apply retroactively. Is that your position?
It would, Your Honor. However, each case would be looked at by their individual facts because, again, there could be evidence in the record that the accused did know about the colloquy. There could be evidence from defense counsel. There could be evidence in the form of an Air Force Form 177 colloquy with the military judge. There are other cases where judges conduct the colloquy with the accused for domestic violence convictions. And so I do think this case is limited to its facts in that Sergeant Turner declared he did not know at the time that he pled guilty that he would be forever giving up his rights to own and possess firearms, and by the fact that the military judge did not conduct the colloquy. And
well, under 18 U.S.C. 922G, this particular case falls under G9, the Lautenberg Amendment. But under G1, the firearms ban applies to any conviction that could have been punished by a year or more of confinement. So that would be any general court-martial. Under G3, the firearms ban applies to any unlawful user of a controlled substance. So that would encompass even special courts that involved a drug offense. So again, with respect to the retroactivity, I mean, you were then talking about a very large swath of cases.
I disagree, Your Honor. And the reason is because G1 and G3 and the other 922G prohibitions are different in nature. And for example, G1, there's not the same intimate connection that you have with G9.
How?
Because of the nature of the domestic violence offense directly relating to a lifetime ban. Take, for example, sex offender.
But G1 is also a lifetime ban, unless your conviction's overturned or you're pardoned.
That's true, Your Honor, but there are also exceptions to G1. There's a law enforcement exception. There's a military service exception.
I know you say that in your brief. The exception I found was with respect to a restraining order. I'm not sure what exception you're referring to for a G1 offense.
Your Honor, I can only point you to the scholarship, which indicates that there is an exception to G1 for law enforcement service and for military service. But perhaps more importantly is the fact that What CAF was talking about in Riley about the intimate connection is that you have a sex offense and then you have sex offender registry, which is a policy aim to make sure that future sex offenses don't occur. With G9, the Lautenberg Amendment, we have the same thing with domestic violence and prohibiting future domestic acts with a firearm. And that's the limitation and the intimate connection that exists with G9 that's kind of absent with G1. G3, I mean, we have several problems with G3, one being that it may be unconstitutional under United States versus Hamani, but even if not, that's a very limited ban in scope. And so I don't think you would have the same lifetime ban issues that you have with sex offender registry, deportation, and the lifetime ban under 922 G9.
So, counsel, even Padilla was not considered to have retroactive applications. So I guess, how do you square your position with Padilla?
Your Honor, my understanding of the progeny of Padilla is that's the first time the Supreme Court ever said that a collateral consequence needed to be known by the accused before he could knowingly and voluntarily plead guilty. Come now, I think a decade and some later, we have United States versus Riley, which creates a very clear test about what a collateral consequence is when it becomes a particularly severe penalty. And then we have a test laid forth by CAF in three parts to identify that particularly severe penalty, and the military judge in this case should have known about it, and that's why it applies retroactively. But again, I don't think that every case is going to be treated like this one, because there may be evidence in the record, and that's especially true when we know that at some point, likely before 2025, the military judge's bench book is updated unofficially to include that military judge's colloquy about the firearms prohibition. And once we have that, there will not be this problem, because the colloquy should be asked by the military judge, and the accused will say whether or not they know about the prohibition.
Counsel, you just argued that Riley sets forth a very clear test. I mean, my reading of Riley was not that CAF was setting out a test, but was carving out an exception to the general collateral consequences rule when it came to sex offender registration because of how unique that particular consequence is. But Riley was decided in 2013, and I note that in your brief, you don't cite to any military case, nor do you cite to any civilian case that has extended upon Padilla or Riley to find any other consequence, collateral consequence, to be of the same unique nature. And so how do you square that with your argument? I mean, we're 13 years after Riley now.
Your Honor, it's true that there are no military cases that squarely address this issue. There's no civilian cases that squarely address this issue. But I think the test in Riley is clear, and the CAF lays out that when there's a particularly severe penalty, the accused must know about it, and then they explain what a particularly severe penalty is. And it's true in the sex offender registration context, but that same logic applies with equal force to the firearms prohibition. It may apply with equal force to other collateral consequences.
So what are the other, that was going to be my next question. Where does this end? I mean, this is kind of the proverbial slippery slope. I mean, there are so many collateral consequences. I mean, you could come up with a laundry list of them that follow from having a conviction. So what other collateral consequences would meet what you say is the test that the CAF announced in Riley?
The lifetime firearms ban certainly meets that test.
Are there any other collateral consequences that would?
It's difficult for me to imagine any, Your Honor, and I point to what we...
So it's your position that deportation, sex offender registration, and the firearms ban, those are the only three unique collateral consequences that would ever meet that test?
It's hard for me to say definitively yes. I want to say yes, Your Honor, but the reason I don't want to take a hardline stance is because before Padilla, the Supreme Court had never considered that a collateral consequence would be of such a nature that it had to be advised. And of course, the Supreme Court could later decide that another collateral consequence meets that, maybe perhaps voting rights. But absent some controlling precedent, I think under the test of Riley, we're really looking only at the lifetime ban under Section 922 G9. As we were talking about earlier, it doesn't seem that G1 or G3 may even meet the test laid out by the CAF in United States versus Riley.
So, counsel, if there's no case law that would otherwise require the military judge to have given the firearms advice in this case, I guess, what What is the basis for your position that the military judge's decision not to give that advice was outside the scope of reasonable choices?
It's the logic of Riley and how clear it is in its application to the firearms prohibition, and the fact that the military judge's bench book is updated at some point. And I'll be candid with the court, we cannot find exactly when the unofficial update was that included the firearms colloquy. But what we do know is that the military justice judiciary at some point decided, yes, the firearms prohibition is of such a nature it must be advised to an accused. And that logic can only come from United States versus Riley, because there would be no other reason to ask it. And Senior Judge Gruen, I know you had a question.
So you say it must be, but the way I read the updated bench book is that it may be a colloquy if the military judge so chooses to do that colloquy. Do you have any insight, illumination, authority that will guide this court with respect to why there's a differentiation between the Supreme Court's mandate with respect to immigration and the CAF's mandate with respect to sex offender registration that would allow us to understand why those are mandatory colloquies, but this is it's up to the determination of the military judge at the time as to whether or not he wants to go through that colloquy. Do you know why that is?
Your Honor, my guess is that the military justice bench book is a treatise. It's reactive, not proactive, which means that when there is a direct case directly on point with the exact facts, then that's when the military judge's bench book will say, this is a colloquy you must conduct. But when they're thinking about where the law is going or what the law may require under, for example, United States versus Riley, that's when the military judge's bench book is going to include that. And the recognition in the bench book at some point before the major change in 2025 is that this colloquy should have been asked of the accused because it's a particularly severe penalty. The military judge's bench book, of course, that process is guarded by judicial privilege. We don't know why that was ultimately included, but the only case law that would indicate should be asked is United States versus Riley. And the reason is because the logic is so on point between the intimate connection, the lifetime nature, and the implication of constitutional rights.
So, counsel, just because a large segment of your assignment of error and reply are devoted to the bench book, I want to follow up on that. Your original position was the bench book provides a, quote, straightforward guide regarding firearms advice. The motion you filed yesterday refers to it as dynamic and imperfect. So what is your position?
So the CAF's position in United States versus Riley is that the bench book is a guide of where the law is or where it's going. But I think it's also true that it is dynamic and imperfect, not because the military judge's bench book or the committee that oversees it is imperfect or dynamic. It's because it's being updated constantly to reflect changes in the law and what is best practice for military justice.
But if it's being updated constantly, then the last official version prior to the appellant's court, so in other words, the official version of the military bench book, judge's bench book, in effect at the time of appellant's court-martial was the 2020 version, again, 7 years after Riley, and it does not have the language of the suggested colloquy or the permissive colloquy for the firearms ban. And so I guess my question to you is how do you square that, number one, and number two, between the 2020 version and then the 2025 version that now has this permissive language of a suggested colloquy, between 2020 and 2025, what changed in the law?
Your Honor, nothing changed in the law between 2020 and 2025, but I'll point Your Honor to what we cite in our motion to cite supplemental authority, which is the update in the most recent informal change to the bench book in United States versus Hartman, including the Hartman inquiry. And Hartman was decided in 2011, but the bench book doesn't reflect that change until April of 2026. And so the bench book sometimes is imperfect and it's slow to catch up to the law. I think this is one example.
That's like glacial speed. How can we hold, if you're so focused on the military judge's bench book and the guidance to the military judge that didn't actually exist at the time of the court-martial, And how can we hold the military judge to that when you admit that it's can be over a decade behind in updating based on the current case law?
The military judge's bench book reflects a growing understanding of the full scope of United States versus Riley. I think that's why you have the inclusion of the firearms prohibition colloquy. And the nature of the common law is that it's constantly finding the scope and impact of itself. And here we have an example of the judiciary recognizing the scope of Riley is larger than perhaps we thought about in 2020. And that is why the bench book was likely updated. And that's why the military judge here erred by not having that colloquy with Sergeant Turner.
Counsel, another question I have for you is, even if we were to find error, what about, I would like you to address the government's position that under Article 45C, we have to determine whether that error was harmless or do a prejudice analysis. What is your position with respect to that?
Your Honor, the CAP gives us clear guidance on what a prejudice analysis looks like for a knowing and voluntary plea case. One of the cases is United States versus Hunter, which is cited to in the government's answer. And in that case, the CAF said that when there is error, that being that there's not a knowing and voluntary plea, the prejudice is that the accused did not have an informed plea. It's a little bit circular, but it essentially says that the error itself is the prejudice. Because in the military justice system, there's a lot
Well, Hunter actually said we will reject the providency of a plea only where the accused demonstrates material prejudice to a substantial right.
Right.
So they weren't. In other words, they weren't finding that improvidency itself was prejudice. They said, we will only find that it was improvident if there's prejudice.
Well, the substantial right in that case, Your Honor, is the ability to be informed about the nature of the plea and the collateral consequences of it, which is what the CAF talks about in Hunter. So that is the substantial right. So not being able to knowingly and not voluntarily plea is the substantial right that's being violated. Pending any questions from the court, I request to reserve the remainder of my time.
Granted. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Major Beasel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Judge Morgan, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Major Heather Beasold, and along with my co-counsel, Ms. Mary Ellen Payne, we represent the United States. The trial judge did not abuse his discretion by accepting appellant's plea of guilty because, like in Miller, neither case law nor the military judge's bench book mandated nor even required nor even recommended that he ask about the collateral consequence of a firearms prohibition. An appellant's claimed misunderstanding was not the result of language in the plea agreement, or by statements by the military judge. And so this court should uphold appellant's conviction.
Major Beasel, do you agree that even if the bench book didn't include the provision, if otherwise the law required a colloquy between the military judge and the individual pleading guilty, it would be required?
Your Honor, I do agree with that. If there was a case on point that said that the judge had to conduct this inquiry like the court had done in Riley for sex offender registry or in Miller, then I think the judge would have to do it even if it wasn't in the bench book. But that's not what we have here. In this case, there is not a single case that said that the military judge was required to conduct an inquiry about collateral consequences. And in fact, we had a history.
Counsel, excuse me, do you agree with appellant's position that what they're arguing for is not a new rule or announcing a new obligation, but would rather just be an extension of the test articulated in Riley?
No, Your Honor, I don't agree with that position. It would require this court to create a new rule.
Does this court have authority to create new rules?
Your Honor, This court I don't believe this court has the authority, and even if this court did have the authority to create such a rule, it wouldn't be prudential for this court to do so for firearms prohibition for exactly the reasons that Your Honor recognized, that there is a laundry list of collateral consequences that an accused could be subjected to as a result of a federal conviction. And by creating a rule that would adopt appellant's position that Riley supposedly creates this standard that if it's a serious consequence that could be lifelong, that's connected to their conviction, that opens the floodgates. And that's particularly what the Supreme Court was concerned about in Padilla. In Padilla, the court was addressing ineffective assistance of counsel, not a general due process requirement. And they were comfortable doing that, they said, because they were not concerned that the floodgates were going to be opened for an accused to challenge their guilty plea because of the protections, because of the high standard of a Sixth Amendment ineffective assistance of counsel claim. And so in this case, where the appellant has chosen not to raise an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, he seeks essentially to have his cake and eat it too, to be able to say that this court should overturn his conviction without evaluating within any of those guardrails that the Supreme Court was relying on when they decided Padilla.
Well, as appellant's counsel pointed out, in Riley, the CAF relied upon the fact that sex offender registration is a particularly severe penalty, that it has lifelong consequences, that it's an automatic result, and that it's difficult to divorce that penalty from the conviction. Don't those same exact concerns apply here with the firearms ban?
Your Honor, I disagree that they do. I think that when CAF was looking at sex offender registry in Riley, it was a much smaller step to compare it to deportation that the Supreme Court had analyzed in Padilla. Because sex offender registry is qualitatively different than a firearms prohibition. Sex offender registry places a person on a public list that essentially brands them with a scarlet letter that impacts significant aspects of their life. It impacts where they can live, how they can interact with their family, and it's much closer to the deportation, which the Supreme Court characterized as essentially banishment in Padilla, than firearms restrictions.
There is no, or marginal, connection to a constitutional right when you're talking about immigration or you're talking about sex offender registration. And I think I'd like to hear a bit more about the distinguishing factors, because in this particular situation, an individual who has a conviction, such as the appellant, gives up or waives or loses their constitutional right, their Second Amendment right. So doesn't that seem as egregious or maybe more than sex offender registration? And additionally, under the Lautenberg Amendment, they lose it for life. There aren't any exceptions that I could find. But under sex offender registration, it's driven by the states, it's driven by future conduct, and there are exceptions that could apply. So is it true or not true in your mind that this firearms prohibition might be even more egregious or more restricting or more limiting for the appellant in their future, such that mandatory notification should be required, if not already being required?
Your Honor, I disagree that it is that deportation or sex offender registry wouldn't also trigger constitutional considerations. When a person is deported, they lose all of their constitutional rights, which was something the Supreme Court was concerned about in Padilla. And sex offender registry also limits an accused's constitutional rights. Their freedom of association is one of them off the top of my head. And this court should be concerned about adopting a broad test when CAF did not set out a clear test in Riley, but extrapolating from Riley the broad test that the severity of the consequences or the lifelong nature of it is what triggers a mandatory colloquy from the military judge, because there is a laundry list of collateral consequences which could implicate a person's constitutional rights that a person might also consider to be severe and could potentially also be lifelong, like sex offender registry. The first one that comes to mind is a person's right to vote. I mean, voting is fundamental to our constitutional republic, and so the idea that states could take away a person's ability to vote potentially for the rest of their life because of a conviction is particularly concerning, but there's more than that even. You can lose your passport. You can be unable to serve on a jury, which would implicate, you know, a Sixth Amendment constitutional right for a person to have a jury of their peers. There are many, many collateral consequences which would be particularly severe and could even implicate constitutional rights in the same way that the firearms prohibition. And so I think creating a rule, putting that onus on the judge that they need to ask about every potential collateral consequence if it could implicate a person's constitutional rights would be an undue burden. And I think that burden instead should be correctly focused on the trial defense counsel. And that's why this should have been raised. It was going to be raised as an ineffective assistance of counsel claim so that we could evaluate whether or not appellant's claim that he wasn't advised of this is actually true and accurate through getting declarations of his trial defense counsel. And that would place this court more in line with the evaluation in Miller and Rose and Riley and even in Padilla, all of which had ineffective assistance of counsel allegations. And we just don't have that here, and so this court should be very hesitant to create a new rule without having that background.
Counsel, I want to understand better your argument about testing for harmless error or prejudice. So in Hunter, I believe, was a 2008 case, which was before Article 45C was added, the harmless error standard, and then in Riley, which I think is also before 45C, the CAF did not test for prejudice. The CAF just found that where the plea was improvident, that the remedy is to set that aside. In terms of your argument on prejudice, can you point us to any case that has dealt with whether a plea, guilty plea, is provident and then applies the harmless error standard under 45C, Article 45C?
Your Honor, off the top of my head, I do not have a case where the court has done that. But this court, to the extent it gets to prejudice, should apply the prejudice analysis from Article 45C. Because since Article 45C was added, it's clear that Congress wants that prejudice analysis to be a consideration when this court is considering whether or not
Wouldn't an improvident plea in and of itself establish a material prejudice to a substantial right?
Your Honor, I don't agree that it does. In the same way that it doesn't necessarily for an ineffective assistance of counsel claim that might also invalidate an accused's guilty plea. And the reason is because the prejudice to a substantial right is that the accused would not have pled guilty otherwise. And that's the same thing that's alleged in a Sixth Amendment ineffective assistance of counsel analysis. And so this court should be relying on the same test from an ineffective assistance of counsel analysis to test that claim that the accused wouldn't have otherwise pled guilty if they had been aware of this information. And so this court should be evaluating whether or not it would have been rational for the accused to not plead guilty in this context as well.
So returning to your remark a moment ago that this would potentially place an undue burden on a trial court, I mean, it's my understanding that the advice would be along the lines of, you know, one line to the effect of ensuring that the accused is aware that their guilty plea may have an adverse impact on their right to own firearms. So, you know, given that it very well may impact a decision to plead guilty, I guess, how does that impose an undue burden or adversely impact the military justice process if we add one line to the script?
Your Honor, the concern is not the single line that this court might direct from this case. The concern is that this court would extend the rationale to Riley for collateral consequences based on appellant's test that he extrapolated from Riley, that it's severe and lifelong and results from their guilty plea, because that's what opened the floodgates for an accused later to come in and say, well, actually, my voting rights were serious and they were impacted by this, and it's a lifelong impact, and so my plea couldn't have been provident. And it'll steamroll from there, where this court would be opening the floodgates for an accused to challenge their guilty pleas based on collateral consequences under such a broad standard. Instead, what it would be... it would be better for this court to instead recognize what Your Honor mentioned earlier, the idea that Riley is a carve-out in the same way that Padilla is a carve-out, that it's a very narrow exception to the general rule that an accused doesn't need to be advised of collateral consequences in order to providently plead guilty, which has been the rule since Brady. And so by recognizing that CAF decided to create a carve-out because it found that sex offender registry was particularly like the severe consequence of deportation in the broad scope, in the way that it impacts a person's entire life in the same way that deportation does, it created an exception, but it didn't create a rule that collateral consequences, just because they're severe, have to be advised on. And this court should also be looking at the factors that the Court of Military Appeals set out in United States versus Badania for evaluating whether or not an accused can challenge the providence of their plea after the fact. And so Badania was not overturned in Riley and still remains binding law in this court. And so under Badania, this court should be looking at whether or not the consequence was major and whether the appellant's claimed misunderstanding was the result of the language in the plea agreement, something the military judge said on the record, or was raised to the judge's attention and they didn't correct that misunderstanding once they became aware of that. And we don't have any of those factors present here. In fact, the plea agreement included language that the accused was advised of collateral consequences, and the judge ensured in the record that the accused was aware of the consequences of his plea, that, and that he had had sufficient time to discuss his plea with his counsel. And so there was no indication to the military judge that there was any concern about collateral consequences on behalf of appellant. In this case, a good contrast for this case is the Army's case, United States versus Birch, which was decided in 2024. Where in that case, the accused, based upon conversations with the special trial counsel and things that the judge said on the record, believed that they were not going to lose their right to their firearms. And so they pleaded guilty with that understanding. And when they received the statement of trial results at the conclusion of the trial and realized that they were going to lose their firearms, they immediately raised a post-trial motion to invalidate their plea, because they had a material misunderstanding. And so that case highlights what we should expect to be done if an accused actually, if this consequence is actually so major to the accused and that they actually had a material misunderstanding about it at the time that they pled guilty. And we simply don't have that here.
So I just want to understand your argument with respect to the harmless error analysis currently located in Article 45C. So is it your position that harmless error analysis is measured by the Badania factors?
No, Your Honor. The harmless error analysis is only triggered if the Badania factors are satisfied. If the Badania factors are satisfied and the accused had a material misunderstanding that the judge failed to correct and was aware of, then this court needs to evaluate whether or not his improvident plea caused prejudice. And so,
well, again, so how do we do that? What factors do we look at if it isn't the Badania factors?
This court should lean on the Sixth Amendment ineffective assistance of counsel analysis and look at whether or not it would have been rational for the accused to plead not guilty if they had been aware. Now, in a case like Badania, where let's say it was raised to the military judge's attention and the accused says, you know, I wouldn't have pled guilty otherwise, then maybe this court has a stronger reason to say that the prejudice analysis has been satisfied and that the accused wouldn't have pled guilty otherwise. But I think this court should still conduct the analysis like we do in ineffective assistance of counsel cases.
So just the language of Badania is, appellant is entitled to succeed when the collateral consequences are major and the appellant's misunderstanding of the consequences are foreseeable and inexorably lead from the language of the pretrial agreement, is induced by the trial judge's comments, or is made readily apparent to the judge, who nonetheless fails to correct the misunderstanding. So an appellant would need to meet that standard, which would then trigger an additional harmless error standard?
Your Honor, that's correct, because Badania was decided before Congress had added the prejudice analysis. I do think Badania would strongly inform the prejudice analysis, because I think in that case we would have more evidence that the accused would not have pled guilty if they would have been aware of this information. But I think this court would still have to conduct the prejudice analysis under Article 45C.
Thank you.
Your Honor, the other point that I would like to highlight is that I believe appellant's characterization of Riley is incorrect. I think if you trace the case law from Medea through Miller and Rose to Riley, it becomes more apparent that in Riley, the first part of the court's analysis is them looking at ineffective assistance of counsel and trying to determine whether or not the failure of the of a defense counselor to advise about the collateral consequence of sex offender registry would be ineffective assistance of counsel. And the reason that I say that is because in Miller, the court had created it as a should, that it would be one factor in determining whether or not an accused had received effective assistance of counsel. But in Riley, the court seemed to take that a step further and created the same kind of carve-out that the Supreme Court had created for deportation in Padilla. And so when they're explaining the, you know, the concern about the severity of the consequence and the lifelong nature of the consequence, they seem to be saying that it is ineffective assistance of counsel, just like it was in Padilla. Now, admittedly, they don't say that clearly, but by looking at the next part of the court's analysis, where they go on to evaluate whether or not the judge abused his discretion, they rely on more than just the idea that this is a severe consequence that has lifelong penalties. Instead, they lean on Miller and they lean on the case law and the fact that the court had previously said that a defense counsel should put this on the record, that they had advised their client about ineffective assistance of counsel in Miller. And then they lean on the military judge's bench book and the fact that the bench book at the time said that the judge must advise about this information. And that's how they reached the conclusion that the judge abused their discretion. It was not simply because this was a severe consequence that could be lifelong. It was more than that. It was the case law and the bench book that led them to find that the judge abused their discretion. And the analysis should be similar in this case. In this case, this court doesn't have case law that says that the judge should advise about the firearms prohibition, let alone that they must advise about it. There's also not case law like Miller, where the court had said that a defense counsel should put on the record that they had advised their client about this. And And that piece is important because it pulls in the military judge. It raises it to the judge's awareness so that the judge is ensuring that the accused has received ineffective assistance of counsel by hearing that information on the record. And so without the case law, and in fact with case law from this court before appellant's court-martial, Gromes in 2014 and then Dugan in 2023, that indicated that a firearms colloquy is not required for a provident guilty plea, the judge in this case would have had no reason to think that he would have had to engage in a colloquy about collateral consequences with the accused.
See, I think that's important because you've got a security forces member coming before a trial judge with a domestic violence charge. And is there nothing in that fact pattern that triggers the military judge's independent duty to make sure that this individual who's going to plead guilty understands the consequences other than just one paragraph in a plea agreement?
No, Your Honor, because under Brady from the Supreme Court, an accused only has to be aware of the direct consequences of their plea in order to plead guilty. And so the judge wouldn't have had any reason or any obligation to inquire further, even given the fact that the appellant was a security forces member. If he had had some indication that the firearms prohibition was particularly concerning to appellant, if the appellant had said something in his unsworn statement, like, I'm very excited to go be a law enforcement officer and continue to serve my community when I, you know, am discharged from the military or something along those lines to trigger an indication to the military judge, just aside from his military occupation, then maybe the judge might want to ask some questions, but they're certainly not a requirement.
So understanding there's no requirement, we have to go back in history and realize there was, prior to the time that there was a requirement to advise on sex offender registration, there wasn't a requirement. Prior to the time when there was a requirement for a judge to inquire on immigration, there wasn't a requirement. And I think that's the constraint here. What precludes us from doing an analogous analysis and saying this is so similar to a loss of rights connected directly to what they're pleading guilty to and will be convicted of, that colloquy is not required. Fill the gap for me if you can.
Yes, Your Honor. So the reason this court should not create a rule going forward like that is because it would open up a challenge to guilty pleas seemingly unendingly if this court adopts the appellant's proposed standard that if it's severe and lifelong that we have to ask about it. Like Judge Morgan mentioned, it's not necessarily that one line. It's not this court saying, well, going forward, you have to ask about a firearms prohibition. It's the ability to extrapolate that further, just as appellant tries to do with Riley here, where in the next case, it's voting rights. In the next case, it's somebody losing their pilot's license. They're a pilot, and they weren't aware that they weren't going to be able to fly anymore when they get out. It's somebody losing their driver's license. It's somebody losing their ability to vote or their ability to serve on a jury. It snowballs so quickly, and it fundamentally undermines the government and victims' interest in finality with guilty pleas. And so this court should be very hesitant to create a rule going forward.
So I understand your argument with respect to sort of the talking tin position that we're not going to expand outside of these very, very narrow cutouts. But should we see that the analogy might, should we see that there might be a need for expansion into these types of rights advisements that affect the convicted's rights extensively? Do we have the authority? And if we do not have the authority, what do you base that position on? Do we have the authority to expand it and say we think the judge should have given this, even though there's a in the bench book is not law. Looking back at all of the law that we've been talking about, if we determine, okay, listen, consistent with this case or that case, we think that the rights advisement, the judge did err. Do you think we have the authority to expand it at the CCA level, at our level? And where does that authority come from?
Your Honor, off the top of my head, I cannot think of something that would prohibit this court from creating a rule going forward for future cases, like CAF did in Miller, where they said that going forward, defense counsel should advise their clients of sex offender registry and should put that on the record. But I think prudentially, this court should not create that rule because of the implications for an ability to attack a guilty plea based on collateral consequences for cases going forward. I think particularly because this court is bound by Badania, I think it's perilous for this court to create a rule kind of on top of Badania that would, you know, give an accused another way to attack their guilty plea. And I think it would be concerning for this court to require an inquiry into collateral consequences when the Supreme Court has said that it's not required, and federal courts have also repeatedly said that it's not required, even after Padilla. And so I think going out on a limb and saying that, well, now going forward, you have to advise about collateral consequences that are like the consequences in Riley is not the position that this court should take, particularly because this case can be entirely decided on an abuse of discretion standard. This court's holding could be very narrow, and this court should hold that the military judge did not abuse his discretion in accepting the appellant's guilty plea in light of the fact that the Badania factors are not present and that this case does not have the same grounding in law that Riley did based on Miller. Barring any further questions, may I briefly conclude?
You may.
Thank you, Your Honor. The trial judge did not abuse his discretion by accepting appellant's plea of guilty because nothing required that he ask about the collateral consequence of firearms prohibition, and appellant's claim misunderstanding was not brought to the trial judge's attention. And so this court should uphold appellant's plea of guilty. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Major Ward, you may proceed with rebuttal.
Your Honors, just 3 points by way of rebuttal. The government argued at length about the test articulated in both Miller and Dugan, that the judges need to know or needs to induce the mistaken belief in an appellant before they can do an analysis for a knowing and voluntary plea. But this test was considered by the CAF in United States versus Riley, and instead of using that test, they went a different way and talked about a particularly severe consequence of a guilty plea. And this
counsel,
court-
if we were to find that we should apply the Badania test in this case for the collateral consequence of the firearms ban, if you look to the Badania test itself, does the appellant concede that you fail under the Badania test?
Yes, Your Honor, we would.
Thank you.
The second thing the government argued at length about was this floodgates concerns, kind of this parade of horribles. I'll stop only to note that this parade of horribles is really just informing accused of the collateral consequences of their guilty plea, which is not really that horrible at all. But even more to the point is that, as Judge Mendelis and I were talking about during my initial argument, is that there are a lot of limitations on someone's rights that would not meet the test articulated in United States versus Riley. Voting rights, which the government articulated, likely wouldn't meet it. There's not this intimate connection that you have with sex offender registry, deportation, or firearms prohibitions. And oftentimes, in many states, it's not a lifelong penalty. It is a minor, short-term, temporary penalty. I also want to note that the blanket language in the plea agreement itself is not sufficient for sex offender registry advisements. It is not sufficient for deportation advisements. And so there's no reason that this blanket understanding that, oh yes, I understand all the collateral consequences, I've been advised, would apply with equal force to a firearms prohibition if it is a particularly severe penalty under United States versus Riley. The Second Amendment and the rights covered under it are not second class. The Supreme Court tells us that in a host of cases, most famously in the Bruin case. And Senior Judge Bruin, you noted that the constitutional rights that the CAF discussed in United States versus Riley weren't as direct or clear. We have the penumbra, we have the right to privacy, the right to freedom of movement, the right to have a living. The right implicated in this case is far more severe and is far more protected under the Supreme Court's case law and the Constitution itself. That is one of the reasons it is a particularly severe penalty. That and the intimate connection between the conviction and the penalty and the lifetime nature of an offense under Section 922 G9 make it so. And the fact that Sergeant Turner did not know about it when he pled guilty means his plea was not knowing and voluntary, and this court should set aside the conviction without prejudice. Pending any further questions from the court?
I do. I would just like to return to the Article 45C harmless error standard. So we have a line of cases that lay out factors for, say, when a military judge misadvises an accused of the maximum penalty. We have the Badania standard with respect to, you know, misunderstandings of collateral consequences. So as with respect to how we actually measure whether there's material prejudice with respect to a misunderstanding, I mean, do you agree with the government that there apparently are two trigger separate analyses? We go through Badania and then we go through a second phase of analysis?
I don't, Your Honor, and the reason is if we look at the line of United States versus Kerr and their progeny cases about knowing involuntary plea, we're not using Badania to analyze those cases. We're looking at, did the accused knowingly and voluntarily plead guilty? And there is prejudice when there's the substantial right is violated, and that substantial right is being informed about the consequences of the guilty plea and having an informed plea. That's what the CAF has always talked about and the Court of Military Appeals have always talked about with regard to knowing and voluntary guilty plea cases. This is very specific, the Patania line of cases, is very specific to judge advisement of inducing a particular belief in an accused. That often comes up in ineffective assistance of counsel land. It sometimes comes up in knowing and voluntary land. But what we know is the CAF considered that test in Riley and rejected it and went with the particularly severe consequences and determined because that accused was not advised by the military judge, the plea was not knowing and voluntary, and that was a substantial right violated. For those reasons, this court should set aside the conviction without prejudice. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel, thank you for your arguments. The court will render a decision in this case in due course. There being no further business before the court today, this oral argument is concluded. The court is now closed.
All rise.